This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions meet business decisions. Online at bgov.com and on the air right here, Thursdays at 11 and Fridays at 2:30. This is the holiday edition of Capital Impact, where we're inviting you to take a look at your table during your Thanksgiving holiday. How did those products get there? Better yet, how much money was spent on lobbying to ensure those products could be sold to you for consumption during the holidays? Dr. Peter Brusa will be here with an interesting story following lobbyist money through Congress and onto the dinner table. We'll also be joined by Kirsten Todd Kuhn, the president and CEO of Liberty Group Ventures, to discuss Hurricane Sandy and a report card of sorts on the emergency response in the Northeast. Did we learn anything from storms of the past? She'll elaborate in just a little while. But we'll kick off today's program with an interesting angle on sequestration and what appears to be cash hoarding on the part of the Big Six defense contractors. BGov's Randy Walerius is here now to help us understand the numbers. Randy, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
I'm reading this BGov Insight, Dr. Kevin Brancato, Rob Levinson, and I'm going through it. It's all about sequestration. $54.7 billion in automatic military budget cuts. Known as sequestration. Got it. Honor before January 2nd. Got to either roll them back or Obama administration. Yep, got that. Then I get to the M&A implications. Defense market is expected to consolidate in the face of budget constraints. Understandable.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Makes sense.
That's right.
The next sentence is what got me. The latest quarterly earnings report suggests defense companies are stockpiling cash.
Yes. I've been going through a lot of these quarterly earnings reports lately and have noticed an uptick in the amount of money these people are holding. I think there are two ways to think about this. One is, remember the backdrop of sequestration and budget cuts. And there's a cottage industry around Washington at the moment with lawyers and consultants telling companies that in expectation of less money to go around, it's probably a good idea to make sure you have a little bit of extra cash. There may be contract disputes with the government. There may be contract disputes between prime contractors and subcontractors. There may be issues with your lines of credit, with the financial institutions providing your lines of credit. With all of these potential risks, when there's less money to go around, there's some thought that holding extra cash going into it might be a good idea. So against that backdrop, I took a look at some of the biggest defense contractors and federal contractors, as well as some interesting small ones, and found some trends. There's clearly among the six biggest defense contractors more cash on the books at the end of September, their third quarter, the government's fourth quarter, than there was a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to compare year on year because they would at that point be in the same portion of the government's fiscal year. They would be at the same point in their own financial calendars and so on. If you look at the six big ones, they're holding about 15% more money, or we're holding 15% more cash at the end of September than they were a year ago. And that was a year in which defense spending wasn't exactly exploding.
15% more cash now on the books for the big six, let's say. How will their hoarding of the cash, so to speak, impact, or will it impact, the subcontractor world for which they are feeding?
Well, hopefully at the subcontractor level, the same thing will be going on. We don't know exactly how this will play out, but if you talk to federal contractors, there's a lot of talk about the government procurement officers squeezing a little bit more out of the contract than the contract calls for. These things cost money. If that ripples down through the process, then obviously the government squeezes the prime squeezes the subcontractor. Just having that cash on hand is a good idea. I looked at the biggest defense contractors or the biggest federal contractors and then some sporadic checks into the smaller ones who might fit into the subcontractor category and found they too are showing signs of holding more cash, again, comparing year on year.
So it's good that our warnings have been heard. The government's warnings have been heard. You know what? This is something that could come down the pike that's going to directly impact your livelihood. A few months ago, we spoke to Mick Weiser, who is the president and CEO of Columbia Technology Partners, based out in Columbia, Maryland. And he is one of those people that is going to get wagged by the dog.
Well, it's an interesting point because there are a lot of different views on how bad sequestration will be, and even different views on whether it will take place at all. And in fact, what prompted this in part was trying to see where the money is, rather than sort of take a look at what people are predicting based on reading the political tea leaves. I was kind of curious as to whether people who had cash or money on the line were taking steps. And of the 30 biggest federal contractors, at least the U.S. listed federal contractors, I think almost two-thirds of them clearly have more money, had more cash on hand in the quarter just ended than they did a year ago. We can't be sure why they're holding all that cash. It makes sense with sequestration and budget cuts coming up that they would do it. On the other hand, they could have all sorts of other reasons for wanting to do it. Some of them may be looking for acquisitions.
Sure.
Some of them may be planning on returning money to shareholders through share buybacks or dividends. There may be debt repayments scheduled. There may be a lot of reasons for it. Sequestration could be one of them, but there's, I think, little question that there's a trend of more money lying around.
Acquiring a company that may not be as vulnerable to the cuts, maybe overseas, something to shore up their bottom line, so to speak?
Yes, I think people are starting to split hairs in the acquisition market as well. Diversifying away from government and diversifying away from the U.S. seems to be going on. We've seen a few signs companies lately that have bought outside of the United States to diversify, or outside of the federal market. Even within the federal market, I think people are starting to realize that some sectors might be more protected from government cuts than others. The flavor of the month companies at the moment seem to be in the area of cybersecurity.
Right.
Health records management seems to be a popular one. Even there, though, there is talk about the need to be disciplined. I was talking to somebody last week whose company has made a number of acquisitions over the last couple of years, who told me about the importance of being very, very disciplined on the price. They don't want to enter auctions. They don't want to be overspending for stuff, even if it is protected, because, of course, you have to make profits out of these things.
By the way, it's called Pentagon Shifts May Overshadow Impact of Sequester. We're speaking with Randy Walerius. My name is Alan Scott. You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Let's talk a little bit, and I'll let you go on this last question here. I'll get you off the hot seat. After all, it is the holiday season. I shouldn't be grilling you like this, right? In your opinion, sequestration, January 3rd, rolls around. Has it been rolled back, or are we in day one of some big cuts?
I don't think it's been rolled back, and I don't have any greater insight into what's
right.
going on politically than
do.
Anybody
exactly.
else. Exactly. I think one of the points that is increasingly being made is that while on the tax side, things will be noticed immediately, on the spending side, the cliff may not be as abrupt as people are saying.
Right.
Obviously, January 2nd is when sequestration takes place,
right.
but it's not as though a ton of money that was going to be flowing out of the government on January 2nd will now not be flowing. Money flows out over the course of time.
Sure.
There is a view that some government procurement officers will be beginning the year on the assumption that Congress and the President, the administration, will sort it out, and that they won't start to worry too much about it until perhaps February, when they then realize or see exactly what the chances of a deal are. If there is no deal, then they'll have to find those spending cuts in the remainder of the fiscal year.
And unfortunately, the money's already been spent. We'll be behind the eight ball at that point.
They'll have to catch up in the coming 6 months.
It's going
to
be
right.
playing a game of catch up, which is not going to be pretty. I've got a parachute in my car just in case. I'm excited.
Good luck with that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Walerius. Randy Walerius, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Kirsten Todd Kuhn is the president and CEO of Liberty Group Ventures, specializing in risk management. She joins us now to discuss the wake of Hurricane Sandy.
Thanks, Alan. It's great to be here.
Let's start kind of in the broad sense. Let's grade it. How did the emergency response system work in the New York, New Jersey area?
I think if we look at this overall, this has been a success story. When you look at what New York and New Jersey did when they knew the hurricane was coming through, there were great announcements. I mean, Governor Chris Christie did a tremendous job in saying, you need to get out. We don't have the resources to come and save you. Connecticut did that. New York did that as well. One of the interesting things about Sandy and what we knew was coming is that the greatest concern that New York has always had has been the potential for flooding. And so you could argue then if we knew that was coming, what more could we have done? It's a little bit of the you can't build a wall to prevent the flooding from happening. So then how do you make the city, the urban area, the geographic area, the five boroughs as resilient as possible? And a lot of that comes from what are the recovery operations that you put in place to address the concerns. One of the great things that Mayor Bloomberg has done in the wake of Sandy is that he's identified a housing recovery officer. And this person is responsible for working with economic development, for working with housing, to make sure that everybody who's out of a home finds a home. And that being that the flood issue was one of the greatest concerns, that's the right way to handle what's been going on. Certainly when you have loss of life, when you have loss of home, you're going to say that this was a tragedy. It was a catastrophe in many ways. But the other part of the success story of this is how the private sector and the public sector work together. And we've talked a lot since 9/11 about public-private partnerships. And it's a term that really has lost a lot of its meaning because it's not just about the two working together. It's about how the private sector can bolster local capacity in a time of crisis. There are a lot of examples of that.
So in a perfect world, and it sounds like you're pigeonholing this as a perfect scenario, not the disaster itself, but I'm saying the response, the resiliency that we're seeing as a result of the city bouncing back, and Governor Chris Christie did such a wonderful job, and Mayor Bloomberg did such a wonderful job. Did we learn anything from previous disasters?
Actually, there were lessons learned from Katrina. One of the greatest challenges that we saw after Katrina, we had private sector resources that were trying to get to the site of the disaster. So you had trucking companies that were taking water that had been donated by private companies, and then they were forced to stop at certain points because they were only allowed to drive a certain number of hours. You had mobile communications units that were being donated by private companies, but the government didn't have the right protocols in place to accept those. And so what has happened since Katrina and over the years and the public and the private sector working together is to say this is not about creating new capacity in response to a disaster, but it's about leveraging the capacity that already exists. So what we have seen following Sandy is Wegmans, which is a grocery store, is working with the food banks. And what has happened is the food banks actually have the distribution channels already in place. That's what they do on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
But what they can't handle is the surge in capacity. They don't know the amount of food that they need. So Wegmans has partnered with them to say, you've got the distribution channels to get it to the people who need it. We have the food that can address the surge in capacity. Another example is Duracell has done these mobile, they're called power forward cells. And what they're doing is they created these mobile units where people could go and plug in all their electronic devices and charge them up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think one of the great lessons from Katrina was we don't need to create new capacity, but let's look at what already exists in the locality and be able to let the private sector bolster that capacity and use the infrastructure that's already working effectively.
Let's talk about the corporate world, because Liberty Group Ventures, your company, where you're president and CEO, specializes in assisting in development and implementation of risk strategies. The workforce in these areas that have been devastated, what kind of advice are you passing along to companies that are up in that area? And I know you're in communication with a lot of them. How are they continuing their operations when a lot of their staff is now, in some cases, homeless?
So the homeless issue is one. The other is remote location. So first, the easiest issue to deal with is a lot of these companies, in their part of their continuity of operations planning, mm-hmm. had already set in place essentially mobile work. So you could work from anywhere. That is one of the most effective tools. Any company that's out there that doesn't have a continuity of operations in place really needs to look at this disaster and others to recognize that a day without work in any capacity can really hurt a bottom line.
What about, and I don't mean to interrupt, I know you're on a roll here, but what about the contingent of people that have no power and have no way to do any work?
So that's, I think that's a tremendous issue. And those, I mean, I have people that are still up in New York without power. And what a lot of them are doing are finding other locations where they can set up shop. There are some companies that are going to hotels that have power and offering to support their employees, both residentially and professionally. So in a case like this, you want to look to see what are the resources around your company, around where your employees live, because the two may be different.
Sure.
And how do you essentially create a focus of operations? You create an operations center for your company wherever there is power. And a lot of companies that have looked at this are now revising their continuity of operations planning to say, if we have to support residentially and professionally the infrastructure of our clients, how would we do it, and where would we be able to do it?
Are you hearing anything back from organizations that you're working with regard to, hey, this worked, this didn't work?
I think the big issue that's come up is the continuity of operations planning. And the two differences are those that did it in theory and those that tested it out, and then those who didn't do it at all. But I think that there's this subtle but important distinction between having a continuity of operations plan that's in a manual, mm-hmm. and then those who did it and actually tested it out through an exercise, what we call a tabletop exercise, which is where you create a simulated disaster or crisis, and you walk through how the company would respond. And those companies are grateful that they did what they did, because they found a lot of things in that process, so that now in this process they're actually running very smoothly. Those who don't have the continuity of operations in place have employees that are trying to connect, and it's a much less efficient system.
My guest right now is Kirsten Todd Kuhn. She's the president and CEO of Liberty Group Ventures, an organization that is responsible for developing and implementing risk strategies, talking about disasters, natural disasters, issues where your workplace may be compromised. How do you handle that? She's one that you want to talk to about helping get the plan in place, so to speak. And here we test our business continuity on a regular basis.
Well, I think one of the critical issues that has come from this is identifying what the company's critical functions are. So what we're seeing in a lot of companies is scaling back. So mm-hmm. you're not necessarily operating at full capacity, but you're operating the functions that the company needs to sustain itself through this period of crisis. And that's also another point in preparation. When you talk about resilience, it's understanding what are the critical functions of your company. And while you may know those, or you may assume that everybody knows those, you'd be surprised when everybody sits at a table. You come at it from your own perspective. So sometimes you forget the assumptions that you make about what you need to operate. So whether it's IT, payroll, HR, different elements that are critical that not everybody thinks about. So part of any entity, any organization's continuity of operations planning should include what your critical functions are. And those are the key to getting up as quickly as possible and focusing on.
Kirsten Todd Kuhn is her name. Again, Liberty Group Ventures, 703-989-5385. Kirsten, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks very much, Alan. Always great to be with you.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And we're joined now by Dr. Peter Brusso, who's taken a moment to examine lobbying money on behalf of the Thanksgiving holiday.
Right. So one of the things we sort of were talking about in the office is Thanksgiving is a great time to be around with family. You have all of this food and stuff around the table. And these food companies have offices here in Washington,
right,
mainly here on K Street.
Right.
So the question is, you know, how much money are they spending lobbying? And it's surprising the amount of lobbying money that was spent. For example, we have Butterball Turkey. Their parent company, Seaboard Corporation, has spent over $145,000 lobbying the on grain inspection acts, as well as the mandatory labeling of origin for countries, so you know where the food is coming from.
Interesting.
As well as how many inspections you have for the food, how well the turkeys are treated, etc.
This is their big day.
It's a huge day for Butterball Turkey.
This is a huge day. So let's go. Let's take a look at the table and what other food products we can find out there.
Well, if you're not a Butterball person, you like Purdue Farms. They spent about $60,000 lobbying on the same issues, basically as Seaboard was: grain inspection, right, turkey inspection. Campbell's Soup Company, you know, you have those great soup stocks to make the green bean casserole.
Oh, right. Yeah, there's even a picture of the recipe on the back of the can, I think.
Oh, it's addicting.
Yeah.
my mother makes the best. They spent $80,000 on lobbying, again, centered around food labeling, as well as front-of-the-pack nutrition labeling and the Food Safety Modernization Act. If you want the green beans, General Mills Corporation, which is the parent corporation of Jolly Green Giant,
oh, nice,
spent $1.6 million, again, on the same issues relating to agriculture. Kraft Foods, who makes stovetop stuffing, among other products, spent $1.9 million in lobbying this year. And their big issue was sugar policy reform and how much sugar you're able to add to products.
Okay. Are they for or against sugar?
Well, it depends on how you treat the sugar. You know, and one of the interesting things, so everyone has cranberries, the cranberry jelly, and that's the thing to do.
Mine on the table looks like a can. It's odd.
Right. Well, and my mom also adds this cherry liqueur to it. It's fantastic. Ocean Spray Cranberry, which is the big co-op of cranberry farmers up in New England, they spent $300,000 all around sugar labeling, because if you actually taste cranberry in its purest form, it's very, very tart.
Right.
So in order to make anything really
palatable,
and you have to add all the sugar.
Yeah.
One of the things they're hitting up against is cranberry juice has so much sugar in it, when you get into issues such as the Healthy Kids Act, cranberry juice all of a sudden doesn't get approved because of the amount of added sugar they have. So they wanted to add an exemption to allow cranberry juice to be considered a natural fruit juice and allowed in schools throughout the country underneath the Healthy Kids Act.
I think I need to be a lobbyist, because in my world, sugar equals better. Sugar equals better.
Well, I mean, they've done a lot of studies in terms of sugar and childhood obesity. Yeah. And there's so much added sugar that people don't even realize that they're eating.
Yeah.
That this has become a big issue for dietitians, for advocates of healthy weight for kids.
Good point. I years ago, I worked at a radio station, and interns, radio station interns, you use them and abuse them, sent them downstairs to the deli to go get coffee. And I would always say, put a lot of sugar in it. And when you think you've put a disgusting amount of sugar in it, add a little bit more, and it'll be perfect.
Right.
And it was all the time. But I guess I'm a sugar advocate, and it shows.
Well, no, you're the increasing cost of diabetes in this country.
Yeah.
So it's a very big, huge concern with the cranberry magnet in this country.
One of the big things that happens every Thanksgiving in my household is we all get really, really bloated in my eating pants on the couch and sit back, grab the remote, and watch America's Pastime. Some football, which, by the way, the NFL is a nonprofit company. Did you know that?
It is. It's interesting how they managed to structure that.
Amazing. I just read that yesterday. I had no idea. But anyway, the NFL has spent some money as well.
Yeah, they spent about $535,000 this year lobbying on a variety of issues related to internet gambling, so people taking bets on games, as well as on regulation of human growth hormone, so if you have players taking that.
Okay.
We also, if you're a little too bloated after the game, we took a look, and Procter & Gamble, the parent company of Pepto-Bismol, spent about just over $2 million in lobbying this year.
So they win the prize if we're taking a look at dollars spent by all the organizations we just mentioned.
Yes.
That's kind of funny, if you ask me. Peter, how will you be spending the holiday?
I'm going home to my parents' house in beautiful town of Florida, upstate New York, and my mom's going to make the best matzo balls. My dad's going to make a wonderful turkey, and we can spend it around just hanging out and telling great family stories, and I think I might win this year's game of Monopoly with my family.
Very nice. How long does the game typically last?
2 or 3 hours.
It's way too much time. Way too much time investment, if you ask me.
But we sit around and we talk about good family stories and we bond. It's a great experience.
Good for you. Good for you. When the holiday's over and you get back to work, what are you most looking forward to doing?
So, Alan, believe it or not, campaign finance is not over. December 6th, we should be getting the latest reports from the presidential campaigns so we can figure out exactly how they spent the money to do how they did on Election Day. We'd also finally get some of the Senate reports in. As we mentioned a couple times, Senate reports are not electronically filed.
Sure.
So we have to wait for the FEC to spend thousands of dollars of American taxpayer money to digitize those.
They must do those in Florida, I'm guessing.
Actually, they do it in Virginia. There's a small little company, $300,000 a year,
just to digitize
records.
Thinking how long
it takes
to count stuff.
we called Florida Saturday at 1:30 in the afternoon. It was pretty exciting.
Yeah,
it was only 5 days after the election.
Nice. Peter, thank you very much for joining me. I hope you and your family have a happy holiday.
Alan, you too. God bless and have a good one.
Dr. Peter Brusso on Capital Impact. And that puts the wraps on yet another edition. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with more about the business implications of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.